Supervisors, please take your seats. All right, I'm going to call the meeting to order.
Got his attention.
Got it. And we will start with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, we have our new voting system, and first thing that we need you to do is to simply go to the button that says log in and click on that. Okay, we have 30 board members present. That is a quorum. We'll continue with the chair's report. First thing we have is supervisor's plaque presentations, and I have a plaque, and I'd ask Joe Veenster to come forward in recognition of Joe's service on the county board. And what this says is coming across the task of presented with appreciation to Joe Veenstra, second vice chair and county supervisor for dedicated service to the Cross County in April 2010. We do want to thank Joe for his work on the board and how quickly he got to the position of vice chair. We're going to miss him, but I don't think we've heard the last of Joe. I assume he's going to be hanging around for a while. Thanks, Joe.
I just want to say thanks to everybody for being good friends over the last 2 years. It's been a joy. And I'd like to thank Tom Rock for his cancer, for letting me be second vice chair. No, just kidding. But it's been a real pleasure to meet everybody and work with everyone. And it's fun to see the good side of people. A lot of times in the practice of law, you see the bad side, and it's really quite nice. Thank you.
We also have one for Ann Fisher, but she's not here tonight, so we'll get that to her later. meeting attendance reminder, every once in a while I want to do this to make sure that people remember this. If you are not going to be at either this meeting or county board meeting or a committee meeting, the place to call preferably is going to be the chair's office. Talk to Margaret, and she can get that word to where it needs to go. A lot of times what we find out is at the last minute, we don't have a quorum. I have the authority as the chair to appoint for committees a replacement person, but we have to track them down. So if we find out at 5 minutes before the meeting is supposed to start that we're not going to have a chair, it can be very difficult. So please try to think ahead and let Margaret know, and she'll take care of it from there. So appreciate your cooperation in that regard. We're supposed to have complete count report and Jeff Blesky, but I don't see Jeff. Okay. Well, we'll come back to him if he shows up. Let's go on to supervisor conference reports, and Vicki Burke has one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your desk, you will see City of La Crosse Arts Board. I serve as your representative on this arts board, and if you see the mission statement, we support the work of the La Crosse Arts Board. You probably have seen things in the news lately about the housing that's going to be available at Grand River Station, which is the name of the transportation center. They're accepting reservations for apartments that will be finished shortly. There are 92 apartments with 29 at market rate and 63 where the rents are income dependent. I just wanted to give to you the goals, the principal areas of focus and so forth. Several years ago, I'm going to say three, but I'm not sure. Maybe Mr. O'Malley can help my memory there, that we assisted in a study that looked at the possibility of some housing dedicated to artists. This is located in an area of the city that will be designated an arts district, and so just for your information and to let you know what our role has been with the La Crosse Arts Board, this is information related to that. Thank you.
Arlene Van Rood.
Thank you. On March 23rd, I was in Wausau for WCHA. We discussed Capital Days in Madison, May 16th to the 18th, with transportation issues and will be meeting with the senators at the Capitol visit. March 29th, Wisconsin Dells, ITBEC Conference on Energy. I have some information in your package. You can read that to what we did and what we do. Also, Marilyn Pedretti, Nick Nichols, and Bill Brockmeyer also attended. And April 9th, we had ITBEC and TOMA. Thank you.
Thank you, Arlene. Audrey Cotter.
Thank you. I spent the last 3 days of the month of March in Manitowoc at a training for the Powerful Tools for Caregiving, co-sponsored by the Aging Commission, and my work. And I am now a certified leader for that six-week series, which is something that is a very, very useful help for caregivers, both the middle generation who are dealing with elderly parents and caregiving, or the spouse. So it's a program I'm really excited and appreciate the opportunity to have participated in the training. Thank you.
Thank you, Audrey. Bridget Flood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the 24th of last month, I attended the WCA Judicial and Public Safety Steering Committee meeting in Madison. Tony Streveler from the DOC talked to us about community corrections early release changes from the recent budget changes. Sarah discussed the legislation that's pending, AB 759 SB 548, which is the local sex offender ordinance, AB 524, small claims court changes, AB 732, 17-year-old offenders, and AB 448, mandatory prosecution of drug charges. The WCA is still taking the line that we are not going to support 17-year-olds going to juvie without the money, and she said it probably is not going to come out of committee this year at all. Anyway, then she reported on the Justice Task Force Initiative on Mental Health and Criminal Justice System, or the Chief Justice Task Force. And we had a lot of discussion, a pretty good discussion on mental illness and disabilities and jail versus community support and also, you know, help with mental illness rather than incarceration. So it was a pretty interesting thing. In the end, they recommended that we go to working with OWI offenders on Monday, May 24th at the Holiday Inn in Stevens Point. The drunk driving issues that are at the state now, I'm pretty sure Jane will be presenting at that. And I think anybody in the judiciary and law field would be interested in that, and I urge anyone to go. Thank you.
Okay. Bev Mock.
I'd like to report a little bit on the White Privilege Conference. I know Maureen wants to talk to her, I'm sure, about this, but I attended this past week at the La Crosse Center. It was educational and thought-provoking. I know Maureen and Steve O'Malley were on a very large committee that worked very hard to put off such a big event. There were 1,700 people at least who attended from all over the United States. There were many high school and college age students there. There was a youth leadership conference for the high school youth. Great speakers. 111 workshops were offered, and the one that stood out the most for me was the one almost at the end. It was on Saturday when we heard a workshop on how laws, beginning in colonial time, were created systems that gave white people more power and, yes, more privileges. Many of these laws have been removed through the decades, but the attitudes, the actions have been ingrained in us, and it continues, the prejudice against people of other colors, lots of prejudices that we have. I want to read a couple things out of a book that I got at one of these workshops. And this you know, but it doesn't hurt to hear it again. Racism is instilled in white children at a very young age. It's instilled in children of all colors, too, I think. Often by the adults children most love and depend on. Children are conditioned to be racist by repeatedly hearing negative comments about targeted groups, by witnessing mistreatment or violence turned on those groups, and by being told that people of targeted groups are less valuable. And we are kept isolated from other people because of these feelings we have for people who are different, and false stereotypes go unquestioned. So it's up to us. We should begin to educate ourselves more about our own history and about other people, and be closer in friendships with people of different colors. Then we should develop communities where we work together better than we often do. And I know some of this is happening, but we need to be better at it. And then we have to go on to take some action. I am also going to read one more section, and then I'll be done. We take being white for granted, and we think it doesn't harm us as much, maybe, as it does some of the other people. But we need to understand that targeting racism and getting rid of some of these racist attitudes that we have will be to our own benefit as well as others. Racism gives white people a distorted picture of the world and therefore distorts our lives. It erodes our humanity. Ending racism means getting a fuller picture of the world and reality. It means recovering from the dehumanizing damage that racism does to us. We need to reclaim our courage, our integrity, our sense of self-worth, and our full humanity. Finally, ending racism means having a world that is right for everyone, a world where everyone matters. There were so many things that you could learn by going to this conference, and it was only just, for me, just scratching the surface, but it was well worth my time to be there. And I'm hoping our county, our area, will keep working at being more diverse and accepting people for their differences as being wonderful, and we'll do better at it.
Thank you, Bev. Other reports anybody have? Don Vina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sat on the Ag Steering Committee for WCA, and we had a meeting in Stevens Point about 2 weeks ago. There were three items on the agenda: NR 151, which is a change in NR 151. Russ Rasmussen was there from the DNR. They're going to change the concept of how they check for soil erosion and sedimentation leaving your property. They're going from a nitrate base to a phosphate base, and that does not have unanimous approval by any means. So there's a lot of things happening with that. We asked for and got a person to come from PETA, or human, what is it, HSUS in the United States. They are animal rights people. The gal that came was 23 years old. She's the executive director for that group out of Madison. They have a Madison office now. They are going to be raising a lot of cane with the farmers on tail docking, dehorning, castrations, and some of the other things. They didn't have a timetable. I asked whether or not they're going to give us any trouble at fairs, and it doesn't sound like they're going to, because these are all penned up animals at the fairs, and they're opposed to penning up animals. Thirdly, we had session we talked about for a while on Working Lands Initiative, which is the follow-up of farmland preservation. And there's a lot of discussion about what's going to happen to that. It looks like there's probably going to be some amendments to it in the near future, which I did talk to Jeff Blusky about, and we went on record being opposed to it. But they took a poll of the 15 guys at the meeting that day, and they were basically farmer-oriented people from all over the state. It was 12 to 2. They wanted to throw out the penalty clause where we assess a penalty for taking land out of the farmers, out of farming. And so I'm not sure where that's going to go. They say that there's going to be an effort to throw out that. And that's what happened with farmland preservation in 1986. The state of Wisconsin did not assess a penalty based on the DADCAP not having enough personnel to collect and or put that money aside as a penalty for taking land out of farming. And so now they're going to try it again under Working Lands Initiative, and I'm not sure if it's going to fly or not, but I, for one, am interested in assessing the penalty. If you take it out of ag, it should, you should pay a penalty on it. So there's going to be a big debate on that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Any other reports? Maureen Friedland.
Well, I just want to add a few things to what Supervisor Mock said about the White Privilege Conference. Most of the county employees who attended were social workers and criminal justice people, and I do think that they learned practical and valuable information. There were some very, let's say, almost academic sessions, information on policies and laws that impact the health status of Native Americans, how race and ethnicity factor into the delivery of mental health services, both in what service providers offer and how people of color use or don't use the services. Some of the sessions were a little bit more motivational or human services kind of oriented. I don't know what the right word is. How to work more comfortably around people who don't look like you, or how to listen better to challenges that people who don't look like you might express that you think might not even exist. So I do think that this conference will have very practical benefits to the county people who went there, and there will be follow-up to discuss how to put what we may have learned into action for the benefit of the county and the taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Anybody else have any reports? Anybody else? Okay, let's go on to the brief training and practice on the new voting system. Linda's going to talk about that in a little bit.
Well, you all saw that your screen looked different when you came in today, and we hope to make it as simple as possible. All you had to do was log in, and now there's nothing on your screen except some links over on the left that you always had, so you could go look at minutes if you wanted to and that sort of thing. But of course, as always, we recommend you don't play around too much because you might accidentally knock yourself out of the voting system and then have to get signed on again. When we have a roll call vote, of course, that's going to appear on your screen, and you'll be voting on that just as you always did. One thing that's very different is there's now there's a logout on your screen on the left-hand side in red letters where it says log out. Anytime you leave the room or leave the meeting for good, either way, you should always log out when you get up and leave the room.
And that means if you go out into the break room, if you go to the bathroom, if you're only gone for a couple minutes, you really need to log out and then log back in when you come back.
That way I don't have to try and keep track of who's here and who's not here when we have voice votes, for example, because you don't want to be credited for a vote that you didn't mean to make. And it also will make the minutes more accurate, showing who was here at what vote, etc. So when you come back, all you have to do is click log in again. So that just makes the system keep track of when you're at your desk and when you're not, so that when we're doing voice votes, those are all recorded correctly. And of course, when you leave for good, you also need to log out. And again, that makes me know when I look at the minutes that I look up at the clock and it's 7:15 and I see you're not there and I don't know when you left and we've had 3 voice votes in the last 5 minutes. This way the system will always know whether you were present for a vote or not. So it's very important that you do that.
And Linda, logging out is just a matter of clicking it.
Exactly.
You're out, mm-hmm. and then immediately you'll get a thing that says log in.
Right.
So 2 clicks, 1 to log out, 1 to get you back in. So it's
exactly.
not like rebooting the computer or anything like that. It's,
and after each vote, we'll still put the results up on the screen like we always did. And you can still look at them as you used to. There's a voting results in the bottom of the left-hand side of your screen where it says voting results. So it's not a lot different for you except for the simplicity of the login and the logout, and we hope that you'll all use that for us.
Anybody have any questions for Linda? Margaret?
Yes. What about shutdown?
Oh, I didn't prepare to tell you how to do that. We'll do that next week.
So you can be in suspense until
then. I want to thank Jamie from IT. She's here. She's the one who wrote the program. I want to thank Linda for all her time involved in this matter, too. I really think you're going to like this. It's just so much easier than what we'd had in the past and so much quicker. I think it's going to be a real step in the right direction. Are there any other questions anybody has? Okay, let's go on to committee preferences for the new term. I need your sheets before you leave tonight. If I don't get a sheet from you, I'm going to assume that you don't care what committee I put you on, and then I can do whatever I choose. So please get those to me. I will try to follow your preferences as much as possible. Keep in mind that we usually have about 20 people that want the same committee, and I'll do the best I can. Arlene.
Yes, I looked at mine, and I put the name on mine, and I don't know if people are going to turn it in without putting their name on it. There wasn't space for
right name. Please put your name at the top. And also,
thank you.
One committee that, under the other organizational ones, one committee that doesn't show up there is actually it should be above, the Legislative Committee. Bridget had reminded me of that the other day. So if you are interested in that and the Law Enforcement Center Committee are two committees that anybody and everybody can be on. If you're interested, there's no maximum number. Just let me know, and you'll automatically get the meeting notices. If partway through your term you decide you want to get on there, just start showing up, and we'll get you on the notice. So any of those committees that you have any interest in along those lines, just let me know. They do not count as part of your one standing committee. Question on committee preferences. Anybody have any? Margaret, again?
Are we still members of
the ballot? We have not been, so that... Yeah, this you can cross that off. We're no longer a member of that. Still in the ordinance book. Bill will take care of that next time we do the house cleaning. Anybody else? Okay. Next Tuesday is county board. That is our organizational meeting, 6 p.m. Don't forget that it's Tuesday instead of Thursday. And then Thursday will be our county board retreat, and that will be at noon. So please put both of those items on your agenda next Tuesday to get sworn in, and county board meeting, 6 p.m., county board retreat, Thursday, noon. Question on any of those? Okay. You guys are as responsive as my students this afternoon. I thought they were sleeping. John.
And I'm not sure I'm going, but I saw something in the county's magazine about WCA district meetings. Is there a deadline for signing up for those? It's like ours is April 27th up in the Toma, Cranberry Lodge or whatever.
I'll make a note of that and bring it to your Tuesday meeting with that information. I have that up.
It's coming up kind of fast. And
Then, if there hasn't been a deadline yet, it might have occurred. So.
Generally, they're very adaptive to board members that want to show up. They're more interested in participation, but I'll check
further. Yeah, it's 3 to 6 at Cranberry Lodge on April 27th. So I saw it in this WCA book, and I thought, okay. Well, it might be interesting to go. But
Steve, why don't you see if Terry can send out an email to everybody?
Those
who have email. We're trying to move you in that direction. Tara?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will you just remind everybody where and when on retreat, please?
Thank you. Right. Midway Motor Lodge on Rose Street. Is that Rose Street?
That's right.
River Jacks.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just touch on, so we can also take some feedback, the items that we have for the county board retreat so far, just and we'll send out some information in your packet for this, is review and discussion of the goals and priorities. So we always send out what you did 2 years ago. We obviously will touch on budget issues and challenges that we're anticipating. We'll also, there was a request by a number of members to review the status of the campus plan and what was talked about several years ago and where we're at on that. And then finally, we're actually going to have an interactive process, and part of the direction will be on the county board's webpage as far as the internet. We're going through an internal process of staff and department heads to improve the quality of what we have on our internet site. And one of the things that we recognized as we were looking at some of these, that many other counties have better pages for their individual county boards. So we're going to send you a list of a number of websites to take a look at. You're welcome to look at more. But as part of a facilitated process, we'll try to get your input on what you'd like to, which county maybe has the best type of features for the county board website. So for example, if you go home tonight and you go to the La Crosse County website and click on county board, you'll see very limited information on each of you. Maybe a phone number, a listing, an email address if you have one. It's very, very limited. In other counties, it's much more targeted. You click on a board member, you actually get a bio, you get some impact, you get a photo, a way of easily contacting that individual. So it's more driven by the ability of your constituents to contact you on things. So we want to upgrade what we've got, as well as have a discussion on other items that you believe we should add to our work plan of services and expectations within the website. So again, trust us, we're doing that on the department head side, trying to look at what features that we've offered and haven't offered and how to fit that. But we especially wanted to target in on improving the county board's page and what kind of information is there. And you'll see a number of examples that we'll email out to you beforehand as part of the agenda, so you'll have a chance to look, as well as we'll have a screen up there. You'll be able to walk through a couple of examples. If you look at some county that's out of state and say, gee, I really like Multnomah County, Oregon. That was really good. Can you call that up? So we can have your input and direction on how to redesign this, so we make sure it accomplishes what you'd like to have better connection with your constituents.
Questions on that or comments? Okay. Again, Midway Motor Lodge next Thursday, noon. Okay. Next is Administrator's Report. Steve has several items.
The first item, and I'm going to just turn this over to Deputy County Administrator and Human Services Director Jerry Huber, included in your packet is a brief report that was provided to Human Services Board at their request on the impact of what we're seeing within Human Services Department due to the recession. Hopefully a number of you have had a chance to read it, or those of you that are on the board, Human Services Board, have already seen this. But I thought it would be important for you to recognize some of the impact that we're having, and since the staff had already done the work to pull the stats together. So I just ask Mr. Huber to come forward, if that's all right.
I always enjoy being with you, but I particularly enjoy today. Where is
the reason I just came from an hour of being reviewed by the federal government for our children and family safety review. I was so glad that I could say I could get out of this because I have to go to a county board meeting. So I'll remember this day. The state told us that we'll fail anyways, so it doesn't really matter. I'll get more into that in another report. The Health and Human Services Board, about 2 months ago, asked us to take a look at the impact of the recession basically on human services. What I'm going to do is basically use a number of graphs. What I ask you to do, so we could have a little bit of kind of give and take here, is that if any of the programs particularly have an interest to you, please just raise your hand and we could answer the questions. I'm going to look at all of the programs in human services, beginning to start with mental health. I'm going to focus on economic support, particularly any aspect of recession that deals with unemployment. The first thing that we're going to see is an intake or uptake in economic support programs. But the first graph that you have here, did you ever been to get handout to? Okay.
They're in your packet?
Okay. The first graph takes a look at the number of intakes that we had for crisis. And if you take a look at that number, significant uptake in just the number of calls for mental health crisis services. This includes basically psychiatric crisis as well as detox services. Anytime that we have that data, what we want to do is to take a look at what is the reason for this. And when I first looked at this graph, I go, holy cow, we got some major issues here, major concerns. But actually, this is a positive thing. The only thing that I think that the governor did well for human services in the context of the last budget, he basically now requires that the human services department have the responsibility of authorizing what's called Chapter 51 detentions. I think I mentioned to this board in the past that per capita, we have one of the largest numbers of Chapter 51 detentions per county. The reason that I think that the crisis context is larger is because law enforcement is using our crisis workers more, which is a positive thing. The graph on the right actually concerns me more, and it basically is reflective in the 2009 budget. Our biggest cost in all of our services is what we call residential cost. And this graph shows that our inpatient expenses, primarily expenses that are at the two local hospitals for psychiatric services, as well as our state institutions, has significantly increased. And I'll be honest with you, that's the major reason that I've been lobbying for the development of the Crisis Assessment Center, the CARE Center, which just had its open house on Friday. It will be opening this month. I'm hoping that within the context of a couple of years that we could significantly reduce that inpatient expense. The other graph shows an uptake in our residential expenses. And one of the things that we looked at for 2010 is that we have to have a much stronger focus on what do we get when we place somebody in a halfway house, inpatient setting, a three-quarter way house. And I've been looking at national data, and one of the things that concerns me is that, again, our biggest cost in human services is any time that we place a kid or an adult in a residential placement. And normally, the biggest thing that we get is what I call brick and mortar. Our biggest cost is just paying for that placement and not necessarily for treatment. And so what we're doing now is kind of evaluating what are the outcomes that we have any time that we place a kid. If you look at our AODA programs under justice sanctions, we have much fewer placements in halfway houses, three-quarter way houses, our inpatient, than we ever did before. And the reason for that is that we're evaluating the outcomes of what we get in providing those services. Again, please stop me if you have any questions. Okay, this doesn't work. Okay, good. This one is a busy graph, and I apologize for it, but it's a graph that shows us a lot. If you look at those numbers, or basically look at the graphs, it takes a look at what is our uptake in economic support. Economic support is all of our public assistance programs, Medicaid, Badger Care, W-2, different aspects of energy assistance programs. If you look at back from 2005 all the way to 2009, we've had a significant increase in our caseload. That was way before, basically, the recession even. So what is this? You have to be careful. In the one thing I forgot to mention is that in looking at this, you're only looking at a point in time. I just asked all of our department to basically take a look at their caseload as of, I believe it was probably February of 2010. And this doesn't show a causal relationship that all of this is based on a recession. There are a number of different factors. One of the things in economic support is that state introduced a number of different programs that counties have to administer. The problem with that is that state basically requires it but didn't give us any funding to provide the expansion of Badger Care, the expansion of other economic support programs. If you look at the tail end of 2009, it actually shows a slight decline in the number of economic support cases. I emphasize the slight. The state took over a number of central eligibility programs, including food share and Badger Care programs, but even with that, our caseload shows a significant increase over the last 5 years. The one thing that you don't have here, which really concerns me, is the W-2 program. Okay, Wisconsin Works program, created by Tommy Thompson when he was governor, was basically the federal model for welfare to work. One of the things that we're seeing now is a significant increase in the number of people that are coming in and applying for W-2 cash assistance. The problem with that is that our funding was based on several years ago when before the recession. And what we're seeing now is that the most recent one is that when Train had its most recent layoffs, we had actually people from Train, very high professional people, coming knocking at a door in economic support and basically seeking assistance. The problem that we have now within W-2 is that the whole program is focusing on getting people to work. And right now we're struggling in terms of finding jobs basically to just refer people to. I think there was
a question. Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you. Jerry, I noticed this graph. It starts to, generally starts to peak gradually, and then it peaks in May and June, then it starts to decrease. What is the significance in that, and why is that?
Yeah. Jerry, the reason for the decrease is because the state took over some central eligibility for some of their programs and took it away from the responsibility of counties. And so, like, again, for Badger Care, Medicaid, and the food share program, the state decided that they would take over that responsibility and the counties wouldn't have to do it. That's the only reason for the decrease. The other thing that concerns me a lot in W-2 that Steve is aware of is that we're seeing a significant increase in W-2 emergency assistance needs. What that is basically families, obviously with children, coming in and they simply don't have a place to live. They don't have money to basically pay for food for themselves or their kids. We budgeted a certain amount for 2010. Within January and February, we exhausted all of our W-2 emergency funds. And that basically, again, shows the significance of possibly what's happening within the context of the current economy. We have a choice that we don't have to provide those funds, but as I mentioned to the Health and Human Services Board, that if we have a family that can't meet their basic needs, more than likely what's going to happen is that referral comes into our family and children section, and then we have the potential of having to place those kids into foster care or follow CHIPS petition. It actually costs the county more, and it's much more restrictive and adversarial for that. So that's a little bit on our economic support programs. One of the first places that people call for help is what's called our Aging Disability Resource Center. And that is really, if anybody has a question about mental health needs, long-term care needs for the family, for themselves, what we do is market a one number that people could call into our Aging Disability Resource Center. And what we looked at is the number of referrals, the number of calls coming in per month. And this has had a significant uptake over the last couple of years. One of the things that we have done differently this past year, actually beginning in 2008, is our La Crosse County Aging and Disability Resource Center merged with three other counties and became the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Western Wisconsin. Some of the numbers and increases that you see here are reflective of the fact that now we are a four-county regional ADRC. But even there's a slight increase in the numbers of referrals even for La Crosse County comparing 2008-2009. I think the reason for the slight increase is that we have done a really good job over the last 12 years letting people know that if they have a question on any aspect of long-term care, mental health, or adult needs, that you only have one number, one place to go to in order to access services. So that's kind of reflected with that particular graph. I mentioned today to the federal government that was here that Wisconsin is different than most states. In the fact that we're only one of about a dozen states in which not only child welfare, but all of human services is provided largely by counties and also funded largely by counties. There's no other program within the context of our programs that has more funding than Family and Children's Services. I think about 70% of our dependence upon local property taxes is due to the fact that we have mandates within the context of Family and Children's Services. I want to just show you a couple of graphs of what's happening in CPS. This is Child Protective Services. I was doing an editorial board last Monday and got this data. One of my concerns is that for a county our size, we've been averaging for about 5 years over 1,600 reports of child abuse and neglect. Now, this is child physical abuse, child sexual abuse, and child neglect is included with that. I haven't looked at other counties proportionately, but I think that is a high number of referrals coming in for our size population, and one of the things that we have to just kind of evaluate and look at. If you look at the right side of that particular graph, is that even though we get a lot of referrals coming into Child Protective Services, only about a quarter of them are investigated. A question was asked today again, how do we determine the cases that get investigated? Normally, we have to know that there's enough that that has been reported for us to actually go out with law enforcement to determine if child maltreatment had occurred. And again, it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect.
Jerry, can you talk for just a moment about, I remember when I was on the what was then just known as the Human Services Board, there was like a chart from 0 to 5 or whatever the case may be, and that has changed over the course of time in terms of you used to go out for a lot more types of cases, and these days it has to be more significant.
Right. Again, we were just talking to the federal reviewers, is that we have raised the bar, so to speak, in regards to what is constitutes child neglect, what constitutes child protective services. And the reason that we have raised the bar is that in 1996, for the first time in our nation's history, they set national standards of what child protective services should do and what the outcomes should be. And a direct quote from somebody that wrote the Adoption Safe Families Act that gave the states the requirements now that the federal government is here for a week to review us, they said that states and counties simply don't get it. States and counties should only be involved in the most egregious cases of abuse and neglect, and only for a limited period of time. What they mean by that is that we shouldn't interfere with families and their ability to parent, and that if we are involved, we should seek what's called permanency very quickly in the context of our involvement. Now, that is the standard. I don't agree with that standard. I never did in when I was in Minnesota or in Wisconsin. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we have worked around that. I think John, you had a question.
Well, I'm being funny, but I was just going to ask if it's okay if your kids are giving you a lot of grief and you can't handle it anymore, if you can just buy a one-way ticket and send them to Russia. Is that all? Is that legal?
Well, you used to be able to send them to Nebraska, where you could give your kid away at any age, but they changed the law there now too.
Check and see if that was still viable. Yeah. But
one of our concerns is that we see a little bit of that happening with other states, basically bringing kids into the context of Wisconsin as a concern with that. The other thing I want to mention is to kind of work around. Maybe that's not the best word, to deal with the restriction that we have in being involved in child protective services for families. We were one of the first counties to pilot 5 years ago a program called Community Response. What that is, we contract with family resources. A lot of the families of the 1,600 reports that we get in, we know that there are concerns. There are issues that the families are dealing with, but they simply are not issues in which we have to take the case to court, file a CHIPS petition, and remove the children from home. We worked with the Children's Trust Fund here in Wisconsin and basically developed a program that if a case comes in and is what's called screened out to Child Protective Services, about 53% of the families volunteer to be involved with some type of intervention. That could be parenting, that could be counseling, that could be a number of services. The other thing that I'm really proud of is effective July 1st, we lobbied heavily, really for probably about 8 years or so, as Jill knows, for a program called Alternative Response. And we'll be one of the three or four counties to pilot a different program in which it's much less adversarial. Many of the cases that come into those 1,600 reports are not egregious cases. A lot of times they're associated with poverty. One of the last administrators at the state basically indicated poverty is not a crime, and poverty shouldn't be considered a crime. And we don't need to do necessarily adversarial investigation and basically refer the family to court. So by July 1st, we're going to have a whole continuum of services that meets the need of the most egregious cases as well as those cases that are not that egregious. Yeah.
Don Bina.
it appears to me that there's a lot more, stricter laws now than there were. And I'm not sure if it's the county, the state, or the feds who are creating them. Because now, if there's a family feud going on in the family, evidently one of the parents needs to be brought into the jail and put in jail overnight or something until the situation cooled off. That hasn't happened in the past.
Don, that's the mandatory arrest law that is in effect in Wisconsin. And that really is more in domestic, not necessarily a parent and child, but any domestic situation. Wisconsin has a mandatory arrest law.
Because I know one individual from out here who, him and his boy got into it, and the boy wouldn't listen to him, and there was, okay, so that's why that happened.
It could happen in the case of a father and a son, too, sure.
Yeah.
But okay. Very commonly we see it in domestic.
Okay.
Just go to another graph a little bit on what we call case resolutions and child protective services. Basically, I just want to show you this graph, is that anytime that our agency becomes involved with a family, our primary goal, if a child is placed out of the home, we want to reunite the child with the family. The best outcomes is within the context of the biological family. Looking at this graph, I was a little bit concerned, if you look at the purple line under reunified, that the numbers went down in terms of the number of kids actually reunified with the family. I think there are two reasons for that, as we were just mentioning to the federal government, that we're doing a lot more in the use of relatives. So it could be that the parent just has too many needs and simply cannot parent a child. But one of the things that we're, about 2 years ago, we had what we call a relative initiative. We're doing more to search out relatives, both in Wisconsin and really across the country, that may be able to parent a child if the parent simply is incapable. It's a federal requirement, but we also believe it's best practice. The other concern, if you look at the far right, and I'm a little bit concerned with, the graph doesn't really reflect that, but I just found out a couple of weeks ago that we're having a lot more cases of CHIPS petitions, that's Child in Need of Protective Services, that the family is involuntary. Usually it's a pretty egregious case of physical abuse, sexual abuse, and we have to bring the court involved. A lot of times they result in out-of-home placement. Any time that a child is placed in the foster care, the federal government requires us basically a calendar year of helping the family get their act together. If it's beyond 12 months, we have to begin to seek a termination of parental rights. Since 1996, I think Bill could attest to this with Corp Counsel, is that we have terminated more parental rights in the last 10 years as a result of federal policy than we ever had. Again, I'm not saying that's good policy, but that's a requirement of federal law now. The other issue that we're seeing is real uptake in a number of involuntary termination of parental rights just this year. So that not only involves our costs and our involvement, but also legal counsel. The last graph, I guess I got a couple summaries. Juvenile justice referrals basically has gone down, and that's not surprising to me. Nationally, if you look at juvenile justice data for the last 5 years, juvenile arrests have gone down considerably. I think one of the reasons for that is that I'm always curious that every time that the budget becomes bad, it seems like kids are cured. We could look at it, our juvenile detention facility, we're at an all-time low in terms of number of placements from other counties. And the reason for that simply is the fact that I think counties become more tolerant of kids' behavior, courts become more tolerant, and they find other alternatives to dealing with juveniles. I don't think it just indicates that juveniles are getting better. It's just because budgets are getting worse as a result of that. I wanted to give you a couple of summaries of what we're trying to do within the context of the department. I did this at a presentation a couple of months ago with the National Association of Social Workers. A lot of discussion, debate right now in our government, whose responsibility is it to provide a safety net? Is that the requirement of the federal government? Is that the requirement of states? Or in Wisconsin, is that the requirement of counties? And one of the things that I'm concerned about that I'm just going to mention is what I call race to the bottom. I indicate that we have kind of the perfect storm in terms of revenue reductions with federal cuts, state cuts, obviously in social services, but also property tax limits. And it's a real temptation to provide the bare minimum in terms of services. And the problem with that is that if you do that, there are going to be people that are going to be vulnerable. There are going to be children that are going to be vulnerable. And in essence, I don't think necessarily counties or states become relevant in meeting the needs of its citizens. The last graph I have is something I've been sharing with my association. Is and something that we're doing it within the context of human services, what I call the three E's of effective human services in the future. One of the concerns that I'll admit that we have is that we have too many entry points for services, what I call too many windows, too many doors of people coming through for human services. And a lot of times what happens is that we get a kind of a jam up at a reception area, so to speak, that we're not necessarily referring families to the appropriate services for outcomes. And that's the second aspect, is that once they're through the door and eligible for services, we have to do a better job in seeing if the services are effective. The buzzword throughout the federal government is it evidence-based? Is it really producing the results that it should? And we're doing a lot within the context of our contracts now. Just because we contract with a certain provider doesn't necessarily guarantee that they're providing effective outcomes. It's creating a little bit stir in our provider community, but I think it's also creating a rhetoric that we could talk about in terms of moving toward more evidence-based outcomes. The last one, I have to indicate that I've been in human services for 25 years, 26 years. We do a horrible job in what I call exit strategies. What I mean by that is that we hold on to people too long. And the number one reason why we hold on to people is because we're fearful of letting them go. We were concerned about liability issues. We're concerned about them making wrong choices, all of that aspect. And if there's one thing that's in the research now is that if we believe in recovery, if we believe that community services are the most effective type of services, we have to be willing to let go, even if that involves risk to the family. And that's a hard one. It's a hard one in my department because people want to make sure that the person, the family, is almost perfect before they let them go. And again, that's a lot of a concern because of the legal issues associated with that.
Questions for Jerry. John Menninger.
Yeah, I want to first compliment you on that last thing about exits, because it's been my perception, and maybe more than my perception, but my experience, that once you get into the system, you can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's true in the criminal justice system, which crushes people every day in this county, or in the human service system, where you got to let people go sometimes.
Great.
And get them out of the system, because it is not all the time user-friendly. The question I had, though, was on the mental health stuff, going back a little bit. You talked about the expenses, but you didn't talk about the income. Now, it's my experience, again, too, for people who are in inpatient psychiatric, whether voluntary or involuntary, that if they got insurance, that covers it. If they have no money or they have a job that doesn't have insurance, the county has an arrangement with the hospitals that they will pay them, what, 10 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar? And then you bill the client or the patient.
Yeah.
So there is some income. There is some income comes back too.
Yeah, John, I think it's more than 10 cents on a dollar. But Franciscan and Gunderson definitely discount the requirement for the county to pay for an individual in an inpatient setting. I didn't even know that. I knew that it was a discount, but it's a significant discount. I found out from the state about a year ago. Wisconsin is one of the few states in which counties are obligated to basically pay for that inpatient admission. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a lot of states, it's a state requirement to pay for that, but a lot of it, that cost is borne by you and me as local property taxpayers.
But you would also then bill the person and try and recoup the money that you gave to the hospital.
And I'll be honest with you, is that basically our recoupment for this population is very negligible. For that.
Trying to get blood out of a turnip?
Exactly. It's much better for us to focus on making sure they're eligible for Medicaid and badge of care so we get 50 cents on a dollar rather than nothing. So,
okay.
Bambina?
Well, there's been something bothering me for a long time with this health care debate that is going on in Washington, and with the possibility of everybody having health insurance at some point in time down the road. It just appears to me, in listening, you know, I went to Senator Feingold's public hearing session the other day, and as I was listening to the people talking, it seemed as if if we have national health care, some of these things that we're doing, we don't have to do anymore. Do you have any idea about what the cost savings would be for the county if national health care went in? Because I would like to know something more about it, because I think Senator Cole and Senator Feingold needs to get some statistics like that and show that it isn't a cash outlay totally by the feds, the state, and the counties, but if we're making a savings, I think the congressman ought to hear about those savings. And I'm not sure what part of your presentation would qualify for the savings under the health care program, but some of them would. There's no doubt in my mind, and I don't know how you could figure that out, if you could figure it out at all.
Yeah, I've been looking at basically the health care reform in terms of specifically mental health and addiction treatment. One of my pet peeves is that the local property tax and basically public money is subsidizing fairly large HMOs. Because they don't have a requirement to provide what's called mental health parity. And so we've been heavily advocating for Wisconsin's only one of nine states in the country that doesn't have mental health parity, which is insane. We've been a leader in mental health services, but we haven't necessarily required insurance companies. And to be honest with you, we've got a lot of publicity locally here in regards to two different agencies, our two different companies, not providing mental health services and basically looking at exemptions to the parity law. One of the things that is going to be required is for insurance companies to provide a full array of services under the health care reform and under federal parity, and we're very close in the state of Wisconsin for the first time having mental health parity. I have to indicate that, our legislators, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side, basically supported parity, at least one on the Republican side. So we're hoping for that will move forward. But it's something that we need to follow.
Well, I got one other thing. Out of these things you talked about tonight, there aren't very many of them that are mandatory, quote-unquote. They're the voluntary, and basically they're at a cost to the county, not necessarily the state and the feds, because their money is going to be drying up. So any expansion of our programs is not necessarily a mandatory one, unless you tell me differently.
Don, which programs are you talking about?
Well, to start with the first presentation you made, and we have more detentions in La Crosse County than any other area. Is it because of our rules and laws? And is this a mandatory program?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Yeah, under Wisconsin Chapter 51-15, we are responsible for making sure that there is emergency detention availability.
Okay.
But Jerry, I think you need to clarify. When we talk about detention, it isn't our social workers that are detaining people.
Exactly.
It's police officers that are picking them up and bringing them in, and then we get the bill.
I agree, and that's why I questioned about have we got stricter laws today than we had in the past. And
right.
I'm not sure why the costs are going up, but I do understand this depression we're in is affecting one heck of a lot of people. And there's people there that are getting into arguments because they got no money. They can't pay their bills, they can't pay their lights, and a thousand of other things that they're arguing about at home and causing this to happen.
Yeah. If I could just share a short person, Doyle indicated, it's a primary reason that we wanted to develop the care center. If we're responsible for payment, I don't want law enforcement basically making the decision whether a person has to be detained or not. They would indicate, and we work well with law enforcement, but they don't have the expertise for that, and that was the whole purpose and rationale for the crisis center.
Ralph Gary.
Well, your last comment almost answered my question. I was going to say, what are you doing with the police to educate them on not bringing so many people in or something proportional to the rest of the state? You said we bring in more.
Right.
The police bring in more.
And
are you working with the police, or do you just wait till they get to the crisis center and screen them there? Or
Ralph, one of the things that we've been working on for probably about 10 years is making sure that we have that working relationship. We trained them on crisis intervention. One of the things that happens, and I think there are primary two factors, that why we have a high emergency detention rate. The first one is a fear of liability. We hear that often from law enforcement, that if somebody does suicide after law enforcement's been involved, they have a fear of liability. The second thing is a strength of our community, but also a weakness, is that we have two hospitals that are very convenient for law enforcement to drop people off in an emergency room. We hear a lot of concerns from the emergency rooms that people are brought there and then law enforcement leaves, and then they have a requirement to be the behavioral health experts when they're dealing with a lot of other aspects of trauma. And so what we feel that, again, the emergency rooms and law enforcement doesn't have the expertise to deal with psychiatric crisis. Well, let's create an opportunity and an alternative with the crisis center to be able to do that.
Yeah, but the flip side would be there's a lot of other comparable counties to La Crosse with a central city with two big hospitals. Why aren't they? Do they have less fear of liability or? You know what I mean? We've got comparable counties and comparable cities like this.
That's true. And that's possibly true.
Well, but, I mean, we have one that we're not even comparable with, Dane County, that has same setup. They've got hospitals, but their numbers are lower than ours, even though they're how many times as big? I think there's a culture, too, that we've been trying to deal with. And I know Jerry and his people, and I commend you on the crisis team, too, that you had established, which also, I mean, has had a significant impact. Jill.
Well, I was actually going to bring up a lot of the points that Jerry did. In the 6 years that I've been on the Health and Human Services Board, staff and Jerry have been very attentive to this issue. This isn't something that's flown under the radar screen. There have been letters sent. There's been dialogue with the police officers. We've done trainings with them. We've threatened to not pay. Let us sign off these people. You can't automatically take them there. There's been a lot of things that we've tried, and in fact, that was one of the top concerns when we opened the care center down in Mormon-Cooley. Will the police officers bring people here? Because if they're just going to take them to the hospital, it's not going to work. And we have assurances from the police officers, yes, they're going to use this facility.
Anybody else? Audrey Cotter.
One of the problems that we have that maybe, or at least it's compounded by a couple of things. One, we have our universities as well to add to the mix, which is a pretty high percentage of the population now that UWL has grown and Viterbo's growing and so on. And so we have that, which doesn't make it easier. And we have the culture of drinking here. I mean, it's not only Friday and Saturday night now. You go downtown on a Thursday night, and you can hardly drive down 3rd Street. So we have a huge problem that I suspect is not replicated, even in Madison, because it's spread over a more diverse population than we. But our population is only 50,000, and so the percentage of the population is pretty high that gets into these situations.
If I could comment on that, Audra, also is that many of our detentions, we say, have alcohol on board. And so really it's a toss of a coin. Does a person need a detox, or does a person need basically hospitalization for psychiatric reasons? I would say probably maybe 70-80% have a combination of both.
Steve.
Well, just as we're wrapping up here, one of the reasons we thought this was important for the whole board to hear is to help you recognize some of the dynamics that we're not satisfied with, just the costs as they are, regardless of unfunded mandates. We keep attacking the root causes as best we can. We don't have all the answers, but particularly on the mental health slide, for example, that's gives you some of the background for those of you not on Health and Human Services for development of the care center, attacking one of the greatest, most volatile costs that we have, even though we don't control all the decision-making that's involved there. You also see an economic support because of the recession, the kind of impact that's happening to families and kids, and the struggles that that's putting on people throughout the system. And the last item that I really want to touch on, just to kind of echo Jerry's point, is that in juvenile justice, one of the most difficult things we have is we still operate a juvenile detention facility. And while other counties don't refer when economics get bad, it doesn't change your staffing or your minimum overhead to operate. So the difficult part is, how do you continue to operate when you have all the basic overhead if the caseload is down? It's not like you have a per-case charge, so that's going to be one of the most difficult areas in family and children, besides the other issues, because that's the majority of our levy cost is in family and children, is the ongoing issues of operating a juvenile detention facility. As many of you know, we've already scaled back in many ways, and the last major portion of that service is the secure facility. So the economies of scale there are very, very difficult for us. So you can see all the volatility around what we're working on to try to address costs. These issues will keep coming back as we deal with budget, but I know that the Health and Human Services Board has been monitoring each and every one of these items as we go along, and we've just never done this kind of a comprehensive report. So I'm hoping that this is helpful for you that aren't on Health and Human Services to look and challenge us on how we're addressing these issues, but recognize the status quo is not acceptable. We're attacking each one of these areas as best we can, and we'll continue to do that. That's how we're struggling with dealing with the budget as we go forward.
Jerry, if we closed our JDF, what county would we be sending our kids to? Who's got openings these days? Eau Claire or?
Actually, Eau Claire has downsized their juvenile detention facility. Dane County basically has only capacity for their county. I don't know. It's compounded and it's complicated because the state is also downsizing their juvenile correctional institutions. So more kids that are sent to the, what we call the JCIs, now are going to be have to be dealt with in the context of the community. So we have kind of a double-edged sword. We have the cost incurred for our own county, but we basically don't have people to our agencies or resources to refer people to. And we are looking at changing how we do our juvenile detention facility this year.
Jill.
Well, and I also think what makes this complicated is that there's an outside factor that affects what we do, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen there from year to year, and that's the state government and the national government. The state government looked at not automatically waiving 17-year-olds into adult court. They would be coming back to our facility. So say we decide to take that chance and close our facility. Then next year, the legislature decides, no, we're going to not waive 17-year-olds into adult court, and we don't have a facility anymore. And the feds are also weighing in on this, where they possibly, very possibly, could say you can't put those kids into adult facilities until they're found guilty.
Right.
So they're weighing in, too. So, you know, it's I think your department does incredible work with a lot of factors out there that have to be taken into consideration.
And none of that addresses anything of the cost of doing it. We can get that additional responsibility. We don't get any more money from the feds, any more money from the state. Only the property taxpayers are left holding the bag.
Tara.
Well, the feds say they're going to bring some money along, but you wonder how much it'll be.
Tara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three quick things. I know you consider this, Jerry. I just want to make sure we say it for the record that when we even talk about the prospect of closing the JDF, one of the dynamics is what community supports, what family support there is for those young people. We think it's bad enough when adults are incarcerated somewhere far away and they lose all of those support mechanisms. But for juveniles, that has a really compounding effect to their problems. And I know that, like I said, that's something that you take into consideration. But I hope everyone else is thinking about that as we ask that question. The second thing is I want to go back to a comment made by Supervisor Cotter about one of the dynamics for us as a community is we have institutions of higher learning. I feel like I should know this, but I'm curious. Are young people disproportionately represented in the numbers that you see eventually going to the care center or for those Chapter 51s or for the crisis team calls, are they disproportionately represented for their population in the county or not?
I don't think they're disproportionate. One of my concerns is that we're seeing a younger and younger population coming into justice sanctions. Mm-hmm. Any day you could walk up there and it seems to get younger and younger. And so is that basically a college? And I'm not getting older and older. I guess I'm a, yeah.
Supervisor Conkle paid me to ask these questions, by the way, so they
exactly.
weren't coming from him.
Yeah. Exactly. And some of it is reflected. Steve, I do teaching too. And so I hear from the students that they're struggling in terms of basically a need for services. And the culture of alcohol and the binge drinking, we kind of seize the day, so to speak, on the fact that we are notorious. And I think I mentioned to the board that it was very embarrassing about 2 years ago. I participated in a national webinar that Harvard did. And in the webinar, right in the middle of the webinar, they had a picture of the three tall beer cans by what used to be Heilemann's. This is an international webinar now. And you were talking about basically what's happening with binge drinking and the river deaths. They didn't quite have the geography right at Harvard because they said that these college students would get on top of the bluffs and fall into the river. I thought they would have to have a running start to do that. But it was pretty embarrassing, necessarily to have our community infamously noted for, but we did apply for some federal state grants, and for the first time in the 12 years that I've been here, we are really aggressive in dealing with high school students and young college students on the issue of, I don't even call it binge drinking, harmful drinking, and the harms associated with it.
We don't have a shortage of adults getting drunk and behaving badly, though, either.
Exactly.
Okay, I want to make that point also. And then the third point is, which I like to ask you this question often, and not being on the Human Services Board, Health and Human Services Board anymore, I don't get the chance to, but if you had a magic wand, having presented this report, what you see in the future in your crystal ball, if you had a magic wand, what would you get? What would you ask for?
And I applaud this board, basically applaud the county, because I don't know if we have a magic wand, but whatever we have, we're waving. A good example of that is that I think we saw the movement of some of the issues that we're going to face in human services when we develop family care. And so we regionalized family care, created a family care district. We regionalized our Age and Disability Resource Center. We just got $385,000 to begin to regionalize economic support. I'm part of the Visions Committee that we looked at, as you know, Tara, in 2003, basically looking at we have to reinvent human services. Our system of funding, our system of delivery is broken. That's the first sentence in the Visions report. But we haven't put flesh on our Visions report. We're going to have to make some hard decisions. And a lot of my peers don't like necessarily the aspect of regionalized services, as you know. I don't think it's the magic. I think we have to talk about regionalization not as the end, but as a means for that. And I think Supervisor Hampson and I are both part of the Visions Committee that WCA is reconvening. And the next administration is going to have a big say in terms of what the future human services is in our state.
Anybody else?
Jerry, thank you very much. Very interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Steve?
Thank you. I'm glad you appreciated that, because I'm always struggling to make sure that we keep bringing you information that's relevant and is helpful in giving you an overall picture. I've got just a couple of quick slides and a couple of items to report on. Ginny, if you could click on that. You've heard that we recently were awarded an Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant program. Recognize that many large counties and larger cities automatically qualified for specific allocation. La Crosse County had to compete for these dollars. And as you know, staff has the authority to go ahead and apply for grants. We don't have the authority to actually commit the county. We can bring you that information, and quite often we'll apply. We're very successful in getting grant dollars, but we don't get everything that we apply for. One of the strategies we did between myself and Nick Nichols and Brian Fukuda, who actually wrote the grant and strategized on doing this, if we can go to that first slide, there we go. And if you click on the big, make it fill the whole screen, it's over by this, the percentage size sign down below on the lower toolbar.
Lower right.
There you go. There you go, that one right there. Okay. These decisions will be coming to you. I just want to keep you up to date. But one of the things that we strategized on was that many communities that were applying across the state as well as across the nation just strictly said, give us the money and that will do one project. We won't match anything. And so we didn't think we'd compete as well as if we tried to be creative on a number of things that were going on to build off of what the state and federal government then would approve, that they could actually get a bigger impact. And so that's why we targeted and tried to strategize on three separate projects. The first one that you know about, we've talked about for quite some time, putting solar hot water on the law enforcement center. And as you know, we set aside dollars but did not award a contract and did not proceed with that, subject to trying to see how we can maximize those resources. And we also want to scrutinize the payback on that grant. On that project. So we're going through a redesign right now. We'll talk more with the Law Enforcement Center Construction Committee tomorrow. In essence, what the grant provides is $100,000 towards that item. That will bring down the payback to down under 10 years after receiving a focus reward and putting a smaller dollar amount of county dollars from the construction project into that. So in essence, what we've done, rather than apply for the entire amount, we've been able to actually stretch our resources and use that to help improve the cost effectiveness of that. In addition to that, Lakeview Healthcare Center, one of the largest costs out there that's very difficult for us to wrestle with is the utility costs. And by way of comparison, just for rough numbers, Lakeview Healthcare Center's utility costs are roughly twice as much as Hillview. Similar size facilities, but a different age and not as well designed and well operated. So to attack one of the most ongoing year-round costs for hot water, that's why we strategized to do that. So what the grant shows is $100,000 from the grant, $25,000 roughly from the focus reward, and about $40,000 that would be from the capital budget of Lakeview. We're going back and re-examining that with the Lakeview staff and trying to see any number of ways of changing that or reducing what those costs are in the design. And let me tell you that the $40,000 estimate, $39,649, actually is for re-roofing the area where the collectors would be if we stayed with the original concept that Jim Spropoulos and Nick Nichols and I came up with. The difference is you'd have to re-roof that anyway. So in essence, the solar hot water is almost an immediate payback. But what the folks in maintenance and nursing at Lakeview said was, what if we relook at not just hot water for the building, but if we located it between that building and the laundry facility, could we end up accomplishing more with this facility and end up reducing or minimizing what that local cost is? So all I'm trying to illustrate for you is that when we do something with a grant, we don't just take it at face value. We go back and scrutinize where we're at right now. And what will end up happening as far as contractual decisions, and I'll get back to the last one as well, is it will come back through each of the governing committees. There will also be a contract between us and the Office of Energy Assistance that will talk about the conditions of accepting the grant and what requirements we have with that. And that will be a decision of the full county board as well as the governing committees. And last but not least was a brainstorm that Nick Nichols and I had, was that you recall that during the debate and discussion about the joint sustainability plan between us and the city of La Crosse, someone had made the comment or accusation that the sustainability plan was, among any number of criticisms, was also trying to close down Rotary Lights because someone had said that was a waste of energy. Well, I've kind of filed that way in the back of my mind and thought if there was ever any way that we could help work together with the community to find a way to conserve energy by the long-term change from incandescent bulbs to LEDs, that there might be some way to do that. Rotary Lights, as you might know, and you'll hear more about this discussion as the decision comes to you, provides fundraising to food shelves. It provides fundraising to 80-plus organizations in the community that actually lessens our burden in human services and many of the other areas, so it has a public good. So what's being proposed is that the grant would provide $19.4 million. In the application, we talked about asking both the city and the county for a match. If we can go to the next slide, it'll actually break this down a little bit more. You'll end up seeing that if the grant by the Office of Energy Independence is provided, if the La Crosse County Board were to approve a similar match, if Focus Reward provides that, and if the City of La Crosse were able to provide that match along with the annual lights replacement that is already going on by the civic groups that support Rotary Lights, you'd be over 50% of the way there. And then the community, through fundraising, would be asked to do the rest of that. We'd end up providing the fastest in only 2 years, this season and next season's acquisition, a complete changeover in most all of Rotary Lights to LED. Now, what that would do, it would mean that more of the contributions that are made by the community would go directly towards public service, would go directly towards food shelves, and make a significant change in that. So that was our brainstorm, was trying to figure out a way to act as a catalyst with a small dollar amount that would end up building on itself. And again, that decision will come back to you, but as you may know, it saves roughly 80% to 90% of the cost of operations and ends up becoming one of the largest demonstrations of energy-efficient holiday lighting while at the same time stimulating public service. So the three decisions that will come back to you are on each individual project, as well as the contract between us and the Office of Energy Independence. But I wanted to give you that overview as that starts to come back through each of the committees, what the background is for that discussion. And I don't believe there's any other community that came up with a number of creative ideas that stimulate and maximize revenue along with an innovative project with other community groups. Last item I'll mention about Rotary Lights, and a number of you asked when we were doing the budget, there is a line item that actually provides funding for this within the sustainability budget, but again, that's going to be your ultimate decision. We set aside dollars within the budget for a community energy project, and this would be that. We knew that in anticipation, but I had no idea if we'd be successful in getting the grant. So again, that's my report, just to bring you up to date. No decisions tonight, but this will come through the next several months of committee process as we get the details.
Questions for Steve? Okay. Let's go on to high-speed rail.
The next item, if you haven't noticed, with all the work that we've been doing on promotion of high-speed rail, is the LAGCO Economic Forum, Friday, April 16th, here at the Radisson. If you're interested, contact the chair's office if you want to register for that. We're going to have the representative from Amtrak, as well as a representative from the builder of the high-speed rail trains, Talgo, out of Spain and currently located in Milwaukee now to build these trains. So it's going to be an interesting a presentation as well. And I believe that the overall promotion video promoting La Crosse as one of the destinations will be unveiled at that if all of the editing and everything got done. So it'll be a good event to interact with the business community and hear more about that initiative. I know a number of you board members have been involved in many of the meetings and encourage you to come if you're able to. Any questions on that? The next item, status of legislative issues. There is some movement on there. There's a number of issues that are moving ahead through the current legislative session. The issues that we've lobbied for authority in the area of regional transit authorities. What seems to be coming through the Assembly right now and has been supported by the Assembly is a regional transit authority, not by individual districts, but statewide, giving that option. Jennifer Schilling has been real instrumental in getting that through to the point on the Assembly. It's going over to the Senate side, and we'll end up seeing what happens there as well. But there's some real exciting opportunity there that individual communities, through referendum, would be able to make those decisions themselves. So it would not be La Crosse specific, but statewide. Stay tuned on that. We'll bring you more information. In addition to that, the legislation that's being co-sponsored by Jennifer Schilling in the Assembly, Scott Fitzgerald in the Assembly, Senator Fitzgerald in the Senate, and Senator Vinehout, what an interesting group, huh, from both sides of the aisle, are spearheading the nursing home legislation that will solidify in law The commission structure that we've been operating under, it clarifies some of the things that the Attorney General was asking about that commission structure. Again, just to remind you, the AG approved the ability to do it. He questioned some of the statutory authority that we have for how we charge things back. That bill is gradually going through both the Assembly and the Senate. I'll be going along with Pam Sim Thursday to testify at a hearing on that. We're hoping we'll get a hearing in front of the Senate. But it's interesting that representatives from Dodge County, from another side of the aisle, and representatives from more Democratic areas are also supporting the same issue, showing that counties can work together to control costs in nursing homes, particularly providing a unique level of care like Lakeview. So recognize that I'm continuing to monitor that and be a part of it. Also, that unique issue around the property tax rate limit that only affects a number of counties, La Crosse County specifically, it made it through the Urban Affairs Committee. It will likely make it on to the Assembly. We're not sure where we'll end up going with the Senate, but we're making progress on those areas as well. Representative Schilling has been very critical to a number of these issues because of her position on joint finance, and so we're making a lot of progress on a number of those issues. And just a reminder, each of your governing committees this week are being asked to relook at, are there legislative ideas that you want to initiate legislation on that will make it in the WCA resolutions packet for this annual meeting? Remember, the deadline is June 28th, so we have two committee cycles. If you have specific items that you'd like to see La Crosse County urge WCA to take a position on, we're asking each of the governing committees on that, and we'll have plenty of time to act. Obviously, if you bring it up in May, you still have time because we have two committee cycles to be able to do that as well. So we're trying to get even more assertive on legislative issues, but I think we've been having some good progress on a number of things, as you know. So that's the last general item, and then the last announcement is tomorrow morning at the Ho-Chunk Building over on Main Street, a joint press event by myself and representatives of the Ho-Chunk people, along with other folks of employers in the area, Gunderson Lutheran, Franciscan Skemp. There are a whole number of area employers that are forming an area-wide diversity coalition that will continue to provide information for recruiting, for competency, cultural issues related to people of different cultures, and really working with employers to cost-effectively provide services and training for recruitment and for cultural competency within our community. So I know tomorrow morning at 9:30, if you're interested in attending, I know Sharon Hampson, who's out of town, has been involved. Maureen Friedland has been involved in a lot of our diversity efforts. So if you'd like to come and hear more about it, it's probably one of the most dynamic systems that we've had, reaching out to the people of the Ho-Chunk. They're real interested in supporting this effort and been a part of that. So I've talked about that before, but there is an event if you'd like to come and be a part of that announcement. You'll hear more about it, but it's part of our ongoing effort to be more culturally competent and more competent in dealing with the diversity that we're seeing in our community. So that's really all the announcements and reports that I have, Mr. Chair.
Anybody have any questions or comments for Steve? Margaret Wood.
I guess I don't know if it's just for Steve, but just in general, I would like to have more of a narrative picture of our county and the populations that we are now serving as a follow-up to Jerry's graph situation. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the Compass study, but I'm thinking, you know, more in terms of, you know, who are we in 2010? And I don't know so much about where our future is, but, you know, one of the statistics that I was very amazed at is that our child poverty is second only to Milwaukee, which is just appalling. And I don't think we realize the situation that we are in. So I don't know, maybe having something at the retreat is too soon, but just in general, I'd like a little bit more depth into what Jerry was bringing to all of us, because I think there's some real understanding that we need to have as we go forth. We are going to be facing some very, very difficult situations. The information isn't going to make it easier, but it will certainly help us see the gravity of the situation we're in.
Terry Johnson.
I would just follow up. I don't know who's going to take the lead on that, but there's what used to be in the Compass report, an environmental snapshot that did exactly that, just described the kind of the landscape. And then the WisKids Count report that's produced by Wisconsin Council on Children and Families would have some good raw data to reference, I think.
Anybody else? Okay, Don Bina.
Well, there's any number of things that are happening all over the world, and, you know, the population, as I understand by listening to the radio, the white population of this country are going to be the minorities within the next 4 or 5 years. I don't know what this census is going to show, but the minorities are going to be more numerous than the white population, so we are going to be the minorities in a few years, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But well, there's all kinds of different things we could talk about, but now isn't the time.
Well, Supervisor Bean, if I can comment, that's probably not going to be true in Wisconsin. I think for quite a while, white folks will be the majority in Wisconsin, but I'm out on a limb here.
Okay, moving along, cards and correspondence are over on the board. No committee meetings during recess. We have two proclamations. We had done a test run the other day to make sure our voting system was working, and it seemed to be okay, but we're going to actually vote for these proclamations or vote on these proclamations on the computer to make sure that your system is working and that you understand how it's working. So, Mr. O, can you read the first one?
Certainly, and I'll abbreviate this because it's been in everybody's pack and it's been a long meeting. Proclamation April 2010, La Crosse County Government, Healthy Counties. Whereas the nation's 3,068 counties provide essential public services to our nation's communities serving 300 million people, and counties provide services that make America's communities stronger, safer, and healthier places to live and raise families in sensible and cost-effective ways. Whereas La Crosse County employs over 1,300 people working with an annual budget of $133.4 million while maintaining the fifth lowest total tax levy per capita out of the 72 Wisconsin counties. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim the month of April La Crosse County Government Month.
Is there a motion moved by Bill Brockmiller, seconded by Jill Billings, to approve? If you are in favor, vote on the computer. It'll only record it once. Sometimes you may need to click it twice. We discovered that little quirk, but that doesn't mean you're voting twice, so don't panic. Tammy, we don't have you. Well, we thought we had all the bugs worked out, but we are getting closer. No, because if we don't have this fixed by next Thursday, or don't have this all straightened out by next Thursday, we have a lot of resolutions coming through
you'll be here all night.
Actually, while we are trying to figure it out, I will point out that the reason that it doesn't work is we decided to save money. We took the yes button off for Supervisor Ebert's voting because we thought we'd save some money, but I think that might have screwed the program up. And he's not even here? Exactly, yeah.
What are we doing now? Okay, we're going to vote over.
Well, that's a good idea. That'll work.
Okay.
He's not going to use it anyway, so we might
reboot.
Not rebooting. Okay. Do you have a chance to vote again? Sure. Can start reading the next resolution.
Been here a long time.
Proclamation, therefore, it's Earth Month.
All right. Aye.
I can't upstage Jay. She did a much better job of reading it than I did.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, you'll be able to see this in the future. The proclamation passed on a vote of 23-1. Mr. Veenstra wants us to remember him when he leaves. He voted against us.
I just wanted to make sure the no button worked.
All right, that passes. Next proclamation.
Okay, proclamation, whereas a sound natural environment is the foundation of a healthy society and a robust economy, and whereas human activities around the globe are causing severe environmental damage that threatens human health and our planet's ability to sustain a diverse community of life, and whereas local communities can do much to reverse environmental degradation and contribute to building a healthy society by addressing issues such as energy use, transportation, waste prevention, and sprawl, and whereas there are sound economic, environmental, and social reasons for local governments to initiate energy efficiency and renewable energy practices, therefore let it be known that the County of La Crosse recognizes the month of April as Earth Month and commits itself to undertaking programs and projects that enhances the community's natural environment. Furthermore, let it be known that the County of La Crosse hereby encourages its residents, businesses, and institutions to use Earth Month to celebrate the Earth and commit to building a sustainable society, dated the first day of April in the year of our Lord, 2010.
Moved by Margaret Wood, seconded by Jay Johnson. Vote on the computer. By the way, at County Board next week, we're going to have an informative session from our Corporation Council with regard to the effect of abstaining, because it's not what I thought it was. But you'll have to stay in suspense until then. All right. Is this the same one? Okay, this one passed on a vote of 24 to no. Joe is feeling much better on this one, I guess. He hates the county, but he loves the earth. John Menninger.
Yeah, just a quick comment, and you can think about it since you're the boss, but I've been on the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee for the last couple of years, and we get Jim Gausman coming every month, the Veterans Service Officer who represents 10,000 veterans, and he's always kind of like an orphan there. Could we change the name of that committee to the Veterans Aging and Long-Term Care Committee? Just a thought.
Well, initiate that in the committee and send it through the process. That would be an ordinance.
I thought you could do that, but
no, I don't have that kind of power. People think I have too much power, but I don't have the ability to do that.
Okay, all right.
But get it drafted and run it through. I don't think that'd be controversial at all.
Okay, I haven't talked to the chairman either.
Well, you can have a talk with Roger. He's okay on it, he says. All right, we're at that point where we have future agenda topics or announcements. Two things I want to mention. First of all, if I don't have your committee preference sheet, please don't leave till I get it. Second thing, if anybody is interested, I think folks are meeting over at the Flipside Bar and Grill next to Artie's. After this, I would certainly invite everybody over there to join us. And Jerry Sobranek has the final thought. It's smoke-free.
On a timely note, in a couple of days is going to be a tax filing deadline. I'm happy to say I filed my taxes. I'm even happier to say I'm getting over $150,000 back. So who says you can't do your own taxes?
And I will take that as a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? By Bill Brockmiller. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried.